Global Capital Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair and I'm the London Bureau Chief at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, the Corporates, Markets and Sustainability Editor.
Some of you will be familiar with our excellent sister podcast dedicated to securitisation. That's called Another Fine Mez. Well, we've hijacked one of its hosts this week. Victoria Teeler is our European CLO reporter, and she is coming here to tell us about the shift in power in the European CLO market. That's coming up later. But first, it feels like we've been talking about this forever, but this deal's finally happened, hasn't it, John? It's the it's a genuine landmark in the bond market, and that's the African Development Bank's first publicly sold hybrid, which is the first such deal from any multinational. Can you tell us a bit about the deal?
Yeah, so this is really, I mean, there's a lot of hype goes on in capital markets, but this for once really is something quite exceptional. It's the African Development Bank, one of the group of AAA rated multilateral development banks, along with the World Bank, International Finance Corporation, Asian Development Bank, and so on. They have all for many decades been filling the capital markets with AAA rated bonds. And they have very conservative balance sheet structures and you know, are sort of among the best credits in the bond market. What the African Development Bank has now done is to introduce a completely new type of security for the multilateral development banks, which is hybrid capital. And that is a sort of bond which is treated as equity. They're issued a lot by banks and by non-bank companies in Europe. It's a massive market and sort of very sophisticated one with lots of structures having been developed over a long time. But the MDBs, with a very few sort of minor exceptions at the smaller organisations, have not done this before.
So what's it gone and done? Tell us a bit about the actual deal itself, the term, size, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so they've issued a $750 million deal. It's a perpetual bond, which will never mature. But it's expected to mature after 10 and a half years when the African Development Bank will, at its own free option, decide to redeem the notes. The thing is deeply subordinated, meaning that it will take losses if the African Development Bank should ever get into real financial difficulty. And the point of this is capital that can come into the bank but isn't counted as debt, and therefore it supports the credit ratios of the bank, and the bank can issue more senior debt using this as capital, just as it would equity. It's literally as good as equity from an accounting point of view, and that means they can do perhaps, you know, borrow about twice as much again, and so they've created basically, you know, two or three times as much lending power as the actual sum of this deal.
Okay, so I mean, this deal's been long in gestation, years, frankly. Mm. How popular did it prove with investors in the end?
Yeah, I mean, the deal is very interesting, not just because it's the first of its kind, but because for once in the capital markets, it was really very difficult to know how this instrument would be priced and who would buy it. You know, that there's a lot of innovations we talk about which are really just sort of small variations of something else or a different kind of organization doing it. But this was so different that nobody really had any idea who would buy it until it was tested. The normal buyers of supranational sovereign and agency bonds are very risk averse. They like AAA rated, low return paper. They're not doing that because they're gung-ho or excited about funky structures, and they just want sort of very plain boring assets that they can sort of park liquidity in, basically. And so, you know, would this appeal to them? Then the second category are specialists in hybrid capital, and they buy the subordinated debt of banks and companies, which, you know, is a very complex market. We have to understand structures and take risk, but they want to be paid a lot, and the African Development Bank didn't want to pay a lot. So, you know, there was a risk of the deal falling between these stools and basically appealing to no one. A third category of investors are emerging market specialists. The African Development Bank is not normally seen as a as an emerging market issuer at all, because of course it is globally backed and AAA rated, so it doesn't appeal to emerging market investors. But of course its whole business model and activity is based on financing African development, and therefore, you know, when it can issue a more subordinated note with some yield on it, you know, emerging market investors potentially were in play.
So who did end up showing up to buy it in the end?
Yeah.
A lot of the traditional supranational bond buyers, they couldn't have it, could they? Because it wasn't rated high enough, or it was too risky or too complicated or whatever.
Yeah, well, this is what finally we now understand. I mean, there's been literally just speculation about this for months, apart from the very few in the inside circle of the African Development Bank and its four lead managers who've been working on the deal for a long time. No one else really knew how much demand could actually be assembled from these different types of investor. But now we know. So what happened was, some people were surprised how little participation there was from the classical SSA investors, right? Which many of them are actually SSAs themselves, or public sector organizations. Central banks in particular buy a lot of SSA bonds. But they did show up and bought 7% of the deal. And central banks were definitely among those buyers. So some of them at least have stepped out of their normal investing style and made an effort to buy this bond. And that's probably, we don't know this for sure, but it's probably partly because of the mission of the African Development Bank. They see that there's a natural sort of policy and development benefit to be gained from supporting this effort. So that was 7% of the deal. The great majority, the largest chunk, went to specialist credit funds and hedge funds. And 55% of the deal was allocated to them. And these are really the sort of specialist hybrid players. There's a lot of funds of that kind that have been set up over the last 10 years. And they were intellectually attuned to this. They all day long, they understand these structures with complicated triggers and subordination. So it turned out that they were the biggest part of the demand. Then there was about a quarter of the deal went to more mainstream asset managers, and those are probably putting them in portfolios along with bank capital and stuff like that, but these are more generalist investors basically. And then there were some smaller slices which went to pension funds and insurance companies and to private banks.
Okay, now one of the interesting things about this deal, which we've sort of touched on already, is this, it's got this sort of, I don't know, almost like a sort of funny paradox, really, in that it's this incredibly well-rated institution with this sort of rock-solid, ownership and guarantees by sovereign states and all the rest of it, which is what defines multilateral development banks, generally speaking. And yet, you would look at this perhaps if you were a credit hungry alien who had come to Earth for the first time with space credits to invest, and you would suddenly think, well, hang on a minute, this is genuine credit risk. But of course, the issuer would argue, well, absolutely no, it's not. It might have a lower rating than our senior rating. Our senior debt, which was AAA. This is, I think, AA+. AA minus. But they would argue that there's no real credit risk here at all. How did investors look at that, and how did they compare it to similar subordinated products where there is genuine credit risk, such as corporate hybrid debt, for example, or additional tier one paper that banks issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting, because if you think about credit risk analysis and so on, I mean, at its best and most scientific, you can look, for example, at corporate credit, and Moody's and S&P and the others do this. They've got decades of history with thousands and thousands of companies issuing debt and a proportion of them defaulting every year. And they can really scientifically measure, what factors influence default rate and how default rates evolve over time. And they can therefore derive from that metrics as to, what shape of company, what characteristics predict and correlate with certain rates of default. And that is how credit ratings work. Now, with the MDBs, they've existed since, you know, the World Bank was founded after the Second World War, and a lot of the others set up in the 60s and 70s. None of them has ever defaulted. None of them has ever done what is the trigger for this hybrid security to be written down, which is a call on callable capital, which means basically the MDB having to go to its national country shareholders and ask them to provide some of the contingent capital that they have previously promised would be there in emergencies. That's never happened. So there's literally no way to evaluate how likely that risk is. You know, if it ever happened, it would be the classic black swan, you know, an event coming out of nowhere. So really all anyone can do is sort of go on hunch and kind of, you know, their sort of gut feeling as to how risky this is compared to other things. What was very important for the African Development Bank was that this should be tightly priced. They have a development mission. They can't afford to pay a lot of money away, even though they're getting extra capital for this. If it's too expensive, it just doesn't work. You know, they would have to put up charges on their loans, and they don't want to do that. So it was very, very important for them to get it tightly priced. The types of security out there for people to compare it with are bank capital and corporate hybrid capital. Now, those are subordinated to and carry some of the same risks, but they trade in the case of corporates about 150 to 200 wider than the corporate senior debt. And in the case of bank capital, which is more deeply subordinated, about 300 to 400 basis points. Now, neither of those pricing outcomes was going to work for the African Development Bank. They obviously had a strong case to get better pricing because they're so highly rated, but they had to go beyond that and convince the market to buy this in sort of almost uncharted territory. You know, even though it's really like bank capital, they had to buy it sort of tighter even than corporate hybrid. So that was the challenge facing them with the deal.
So who won? I mean, how did it come out? How much has this cost African Development Bank compared to its senior bonds, for example? And how does 5.75% look versus other sort of corporate hybrids and Bank 81?
Yeah. Now we have the answer to the question that everyone involved with this has been wanting to know for well over a year, which is how would it be priced? What would the market actually bear? And the, you know, when we spoke to the African Development Bank last year, long before this came out, we gained the impression that their target range was 100 to 150 basis points, which would be just inside where corporate hybrid trades relative to their senior debt. Now, the bond was priced at 5.75% coupon, and it is a 10.5-year bond. If you believe in the call date. Now, the African Development Bank thinks it could issue a new 10-year dollar bond at 23 basis points over US Treasuries. And this one came at 157. So that gap is 134 basis points. And that is what they think is the basically what you call the senior subordinated differential, the amount extra they've had to pay to issue this subordinated note versus a senior one. And so they've hit the target. And they've proved that it can be done at a level that is, you know, efficient for the African Development Bank. Now, you know, all the other development banks, if they are looking at this, will have their own calculations in mind already. You know, what level of senior sub differential might work for us if we did this, but now they've got a piece of data to actually sort of, you know, evaluate the possibilities.
One thing that interests me about this is this deal attracted a $6 billion order book at its peak. Now, given the aim of the product is to allow the AFDB to lend more, why did they only do $750 million?
Hmm. Yeah, that's lots of people have wondered that, actually. Now, what they've told us is that it was driven by their internal needs. They don't actually need the full billion right now. However, I did ask them, you know, on the very day that you launched the deal, Tuesday this week, was a $1 billion deal still a possibility? And they said yes. So which means that it was partly driven by the book build outcome. Now, my interpretation is they had a massive book for it, but they also wanted, because of their extreme price sensitivity about it, they wanted to be absolutely sure to get the tightest price. And they, I think, also probably wanted the bond to tighten in the secondary market. So it's more important for them to have a really successful deal that just shines, and that where the investors have a good experience, it tightens in the secondary market, and you know, everyone feels good about it, than to get that extra $250 million right now. Because yeah, they can always come back for that some other time.
Yeah, and they will take the view, I guess, that the second time, you know, everyone will be feeling good and there'll be more demand next time. And also more people will be used to the product and interested in buying it.
Yeah. So, and I think, and you know, by the morning after the deal, it did tighten. You know, it went up in the secondary market. I mean, it helps that you've got investors involved, which are gung-ho, risk-taking investors. You know, all these specialist credit funds and hedge funds and so on, you know, they know how to trade and take risks. So they're exactly the kind of investors that will, pile in the secondary market if they like it.
So how much of a benchmark is this, though, for other MDBs? Because, yes, it's the first publicly sold deal, and we know that others are coming, because MDBs would have been working on these in the background for a long, long time. But each MDB is different, isn't it, in its terms of how it's set up and how it's owned. So each deal will have its own little quirks. So what's the read across for other MDBs, and do we know who's next?
Yeah, so we should mention at this point that there have been some other hybrid capital issues. I mean, there are a few in the dim and distant past out of the SSA sector, but not really from MDBs. But the two that have issued privately in the last 6 months are the World Bank, which placed €305 million of hybrid capital with Germany, one of its shareholders, in a private transaction. And the Banque West Africaine de Développement, or BOAD, the West African Development Bank, a smaller MDB in Africa, which did a deal with the Arab Bank for Development in Africa in December for $100 million. Now, these are placed privately with sort of investors that care about their mission, and they're not asking for commercial terms. So that's what was so important about the AFDB deal, is it was out in the public market with commercial investors. But in the background, lots of the MDBs are exploring this. They are exploring private placement with their own shareholders. The World Bank wants to do more of that. The BOAD is doing more of that. But the World Bank and European Bank for Reconstruction and Development have both said that they will issue public hybrids as well. Probably both up to $1 billion worth in each case as a pilot. You know, they want to see if it works, if it's efficient and so on. I would expect both of those deals to come this year. But we don't have any sort of very up-to-date information on how plans are progressing. But certainly, I think both of them will take great interest in what the African Development Bank has achieved, the pricing it got, the demand, and that will inform their decision about whether to bring it and when.
And this is also a hot topic for us, isn't it? Because we have an event coming up at the end of this month discussing this very topic, don't we? And I'm sure that the fact that the AFDB has now priced its deal will really make that quite a morning. What are we doing, John?
Yes, it's the second of our GC Live events. It's on the 27th of February, beginning at 8 in the morning in London. And we've got African Development Bank will be speaking there, as will the EBRD. So it's a sort of event for global capital subscribers to discuss an issue in sort of an intimate way.
Yeah, that's right. We've done one of these so far for UK bank capital, and it really is informal and a chance to hear stuff off the record and to mingle with the key players in that particular market. Now, there will be sort of three discussion sessions at the event. one of which will be published afterwards, but the other two you will never hear about unless you're in the room at the time. And you will only be able to get into the room if you're a GC trialist or subscriber. So make sure you sign up to get access. You'll be in the room with, you know, issuers, investors, bankers and whoever else, really, but really the key players from across this particular market. And there'll be plenty of time just to sort of mingle with them in the room. It's not like a big conference where you've got to sort of rush around booking meetings or any of that nonsense. You literally bump into all sorts of people just by hanging out by the croissants. So heartily recommend them. And they were good croissants last time too, weren't they, John?
I think I was a bit busy at the time, but you know, I did see people eating them.
Yes, and just in case our boss is listening, I was busy too and definitely didn't eat any of the croissants. So, yeah, do join us on 27th of February. If you go to the Global Capital website, which is globalcapital.com, and if you look at the navigation bar along the top, you'll see a bit there to click on. So go to GC Live, and if you click on that and you click on the event, you'll be able to see who to get in touch with and how to get your ticket. We'll very much look forward to seeing you. And of course, we look forward to your further coverage of this really important and developing market, which you're writing in conjunction with our SSA bond reporting team of Addison Gong, who's the SSA bonds editor, and Georgie Lee, who is the SSA bonds reporter. Moving to the CLO market, we spoke to Victoria Teeler about a shifting power dynamics. Hello, Victoria, and after a long absence, welcome back to the Global Capital Podcast.
Thank you, Ralph. Nice to be back.
Right, we're going to be talking about collateralized loan obligations, your specialist subject this morning. And normally, in a bond sale, it's usually a case of investors versus issuers in terms of competing interests. One wants to earn more, the other one wants to pay less. In a CLO, different groups of investors are almost have competing interests. Can you outline for us how a CLO works and why it sets different groups of investors in the same deal against each other like that?
Yes, of course. So I think calling a CLO a bond sale is a huge injustice to this beautiful product, which is essentially a securitization of broadly syndicated loans. And unlike other syndication and other securitizations that usually are a way for somebody to securitize their own assets and fund their lending through that, CLOs are usually issued by so-called CLO managers who first buy the loans and then issue the debt. And a CLO has debt tranches all the way from AAAs through the whole mezzanine down to the equity. So CLO managers do, in a normal market, try to sell equity to third-party investors, and their main earning potential for the CLO manager themselves is the fees that they charge for structuring that whole thing. And structuring is the banks. Their main income is the fees they charge for managing the CLO and the portfolio. Of course, if you get external equities investors on board, they're the ones who are paid last. After you've paid down all the debt tranches, the equity investors get whatever is left. It's a similar structure to the issuer versus investor struggle in other parts of the bond market, because of course, for a AAA debt investor, just wants their money as they were promised, scheduled regular payments, sticking to the books. Whereas for the equity investors, it's important to have flexibility. They want to trade, they want to increase their returns. There's where that struggle comes from.
Yeah, so they're last to get paid, but that obviously then gives them the right to the flexibility to try and get as exactly much out of the structure as possible. And they can get a lot or they can get absolutely nothing. That's the risk, isn't it?
I mean, it should be
exactly, and they usually hope for a
it
long.
Should be said that the structure is meant to work so that the interests of all the investors are aligned. And at the most basic level, it is that basically you want a portfolio of good assets that doesn't default and that repays and makes money for everybody. But I think what you're talking about is that within that, there's the CLO equity investors are more inclined to give the manager flexibility in how they do that, and to take sometimes more risk, or to kind of keep the CLO running for longer, right? Whereas the AAA investors and the other senior investors just want something very simple. They only care about their own principal being returned and so on. So they would favour a more conservative style of management of the assets.
Exactly. And I think there's an important point to make about that exposure to defaults that you just mentioned, the potential for defaults in the portfolio, because AAA investors are almost never affected by that, or have historically never been affected by that in European CLO history. So they are not at all, they don't expect to be exposed, they don't care that much about the credit quality. They're more, usually more concerned with like the issuance history and if the manager has always paid them out. But yeah, I think that is important to note, that those groups of investors also have different concerns. The equity would of course be immediately hit by any defaults, and so would be sort of the single B, double B investors. But then from triple B upwards, it gets a lot less. The risk of actually being affected by defaults is very low.
So which of those sets of investors has had the upper hand lately then?
Definitely the AAA investors. Spoiler for the longer answer. So for the past 1.5 years, after sort of the invasion of Ukraine and then the inflation that followed and rising interest rates, CLO managers basically struggled to sell both the equity and the AAA tranche in a volatile market. But they mostly solved that by retaining the equity themselves, because external equity investors didn't really want to come in because it was quite risky, and they could usually get a better return just investing in the lower mezzanine tranches at a lower risk. And yeah, spreads were quite wide, and so CLO managers sort of sorted that problem by taking the equity themselves, didn't have to worry about getting external equity anymore. So their next biggest problem was to secure the AAA tranche, because in a CLO, that's usually like the really big tranche. If a CLO is like 400 million euros, that's 240 of that will be AAA, like plus minus can vary, but that's sort of like, that wouldn't be unrealistic. So that's the one you really need to get secured.
You mean to get it placed with investors?
To get it placed, yeah. So a lot of people went for, tried to get anchor investors, was generally a bit challenging. And that, of course, gave those AAA investors a lot of bargaining power, because CLOs are quite tailor-made. There's a lot of negotiation about the exact terms of the CLO that happens for each and every deal. And all the investors are involved in that. So the AAA investors basically had got everything they wanted. Well, that's maybe a bit too much, but like they had a lot of power for the past 1.5 years.
And why has that now changed? Why has the balance of power shifted more towards equity investors? Is this to do with the sort of predictions that interest rates are about to plummet, which, you know, if we're led to believe by the market, is, you know, just around the corner?
Exactly. Very, very realistic scenario. 150% this year. Absolutely. Subscribe to that. But technically, yeah. So for the past 1.5 years, it was very difficult for CLO managers to make the arbitrage work. Debts were super wide. Like spreads for the CLO manager issuing the debt were super wide. So it was really expensive. Not much left for the equity. But now, at the start of this year, we've seen a massive tightening of CLO liabilities. So this will sound really wild for any listeners who work in like SSAs or something, but so before Christmas, CLO AAAs were priced at like 173 base points over 3 months Euribor, and now over the past month they have gone down to 150, which is intense tightening. And this was caused partly because there was a tightening in general credit markets because of greater optimism about interest rates, but there was also just bigger investor demand. It was partly start of the year, everybody has new allocations, but then also US banks are seeing for the first time in a long time better relative value in Europe, so they were coming in a bit. Japanese investors are there, European investors are also there. A lot of investors seem to want to take advantage of There's still relatively widespread in CLOs compared to other markets, even though they're tightening. So there was a lot of demand and support, and that meant that suddenly the equity is getting more attractive again, because you don't have to spread the tightening, you don't have to pay everybody that much. So we had not the first deal, but one of the very, it's been very rare that anybody has significant equity. And at the end of last week, SoundPoint managed to price a CLO with like 6 or 7 external equities investors in there. So it is possible again. And apparently all managers are marketing equity again. So there is the hope that the market is returning a bit more to normal. And with that would obviously come that AAA investors wouldn't have this, like the power wouldn't be skewed so much towards them, because first of all, more competition between them. So like if you have, I don't know, 10 investors competing over the bond, then, well, the one who's less of a nuisance to the CLO manager will probably have a better shout. And at the same time, there's also equity investors just coming back to the table and also having interests and, maybe pushing the manager more to push on some of the boundaries of the AAA investors. So, I definitely had some AAA investors express to me that they're a bit nervous about terms getting too equity friendly now.
I'm just sticking with the pricing for a second. Has the pricing sort of changed on the asset side from the CLO manager's point of view?
It has, yeah. not exactly to their benefit. We had a bit of a problem for also for the past 1.5 years that primary loan supply in the broadly syndicated market was very low. As I'm sure many people who work in other markets know, bank lending wasn't so much a thing for part of it. And then we had the rise of private credit and everything. But yeah, so there's little primary loan issuance, and as a result, prices in the secondary market for loans have gone up, way up throughout the last year. There was like a bit of ups and downs, but they're generally quite expensive for managers right now. For the past few weeks or so loan prices tightened quite a lot at the end of last year and quite quickly. But then since the start of this year, it's been a bit slower, and the tightening of CLO spreads was much faster. The arbitrage is still not perfect and amazing. Spreads are still higher than their long-term averages in Europe, and loan prices are still high, but it's definitely been moving towards a direction where equity is becoming more attractive again.
So, Victoria, you're talking about the CLO equity investors and the AAA investors fighting over certain issues, or at least having a tug of war over the terms. So what are the issues that they differ on?
There's a number of different ones. A few examples that come up quite often in conversations with lawyers and investors about this is, for example, the flexibility of a CLO manager to keep trading loans after the reinvestment period had ended. So a CLO is supposed to have a period where the CLO manager can trade and buy and sell loans and improve the returns for the equity and potentially himself. They do have to retain a little bit of it on each deal. So that is normally somewhere around 4.5 years. And then afterwards, the amortization period should start, where the CLO manager stops trading around and starts just paying everybody in the debt waterfall structure down. But of course, the AAA bad debt investors usually just want that to happen. But for the CLO manager and the equity investors, of course, it's way better if after the reinvestment period ends, they can still do at least a little bit of trading, where if a certain loan is doing really badly, they can exchange it, or they can participate in maturity extensions if they would rather keep the CLO alive, which was attractive for the past year or so. So there's a lot of tugging about that, related to that also possibility for the manager to extend the weighted average life of the deal, which means sort of the average maturity of the loans in the portfolio. And another point is the so-called par flush. So normally the CLO manager has to pay the AAA first and then the AA and all the way down, and the equity gets what's left, as we've just talked about. But there is the option of the so-called par flush, where the manager uses principal, which he or she gets from buying and selling loans, to do an extra outpayment to the equity investors outside of this waterfall structures, which obviously is great for equity investors because they get some money, and the debt investors like to see that less because it skips them, and there's usually a cap on that. It's often 1%, so more flexible terms for that are, for example, also under discussion. So these would be sort of the main ones that come up.
And you talked about CLO equity investors coming back to the market, and at the moment the CLO equity is having power, and you expect that to continue. And of course, when you have external clients to service on at the equity level, you're going to, you know, their needs are going to be higher and more prioritized. You're going to have to sort of please them much more than you would yourself if you're the CLO manager that has been just exactly holding the equity for a bit. But will there come a point when the number of CLO equity investors becomes excessive, and there starts to be competition among them, and therefore their power at the negotiating table starts to weaken again?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is always a very supply and demand driven dynamic, and the CLO market has been, at least since I covered it, very strongly driven by these technical mechanisms. I don't see that happening quite yet. Right now, the equity is starting to get more attractive again and starting to make sense, but not in a way where it's an absolute must buy and everybody is rushing in. For that to happen, we would either have to have a massive further drop in liability spreads, or loans would have to become way cheaper. It's very unlikely that loans are going to plunge in price, at least in the next 6 months or so. We still don't really have a M&A market, and it's expected to remain quite quiet. And on the CLO liability side, there could be some further tightening. So I think it would probably not be unrealistic to go into the 140s, but people also don't expect that is going to massively plunge. They've just tightened so much. They might be coming into the next range that they're bound to. But yeah, technically, if in the future one of those factors changes dramatically, then definitely that balance could completely tilt the other way.